Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Jacox with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who examines the government's surveillance of Associated Press reporters' phone lines and the Obama administration's plan to overhaul federal surveillance laws. Carlos Warner, an assistant federal defender representing 11 men held at Guantanamo Bay detention camp, who challenges President Obama's inaction in releasing cleared detainees and closing the U.S.-run prison in Cuba. And Emma Schuss of the group Earth Justice, who explains the significance of a U.S. Court of Appeals decision affirming the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to revoke mountaintop removal mining permits. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An historic opportunity to build new clean water infrastructure during Haiti's dry season has been lost due to international indifference. Now, as the rainy season starts, cases of cholera are expected to spike. As United Nations peacekeepers are blamed for bringing the first cases of cholera to Haiti in October 2010, the international body faces a threatened class action lawsuit unless compensation is given to disease victims. Since the fall of 2010, more than 650,000 Haitians have become sick with cholera and over 8,100 people have died. The Miami Herald quoted French epidemiologist Dr. Renaud Poirot as saying, "Cholera could be eliminated from Haiti with aggressive treatment and new investments in clean water systems, but donor nations have become increasingly tight-fisted in providing aid to Haiti." Doctors Without Borders noted the number of cholera treatment centers in Haiti has fallen by nearly 80%, and the current cholera monitoring network is breaking down. Jack Johnson, a blogger on Haiti with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, recently wrote, "This is the third year that funding for cholera has diminished prior to the rainy season, when cases will predictably spike, leading to more preventable and unnecessary deaths." Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's new lobby group, Forward.us, with a $40 million bank account and no obligation to disclose donors, ran ads recently supporting incumbent Republicans and a conservative Democrat, praising their support for the Keystone XL pipeline, more drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and opposition to Obamacare. The aggressive ads triggered a split in the normally liberal Silicon Valley community, which has invested heavily in clean technologies. The ads were designed to provide political cover to politicians, including Senator Mark Begich, Democrat of Alaska, and South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, encouraging them to take a more moderate stand in support of immigration reform. But some observers say the ads may backfire by mobilizing green activists and rival tech moguls against Zuckerberg and his lobby group allies, Bill Gates and Eric Schmidt of Google. Right after the ads ran, the Sierra Club used its Facebook page to tell Zuckerberg to wise up and change strategy. A coalition of progressive groups sought to run ads on Facebook attacking Zuckerberg's lobby group, but Facebook rejected the ads. In response, activists led a protest outside Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park, California. Nick Burning, a spokesman for MoveOn.org, observed, "MoveOn members are committed to passing a comprehensive immigration reform bill this year, but unlike Forward.us, we don't support throwing other important issues like access to health care and action to combat climate change under the bus to do it." According to the Center for Public Integrity, Florida has experienced a surge in gun violence over the last decade, with the number of gun murders rising by 38%. In the first half of 2012, guns were used in 75% of all murders, at the same time that the overall murder rate was falling and violent crime dropped statewide. Florida's permissive gun law grabbed headlines with the February 2012 murder of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin at the hands of George Zimmerman, who used the state's Stand Your Ground gun law as a defense. In Florida, the number of residents applying for a background check to buy firearms surged after 2004, but the state has a poor record of submitting mental health records to the federal database. Currently, background checks are not required for all firearms sold at gun shows or in private sales. Despite a nationwide campaign responding to last December's Newtown, Connecticut school massacre, the National Rifle Association succeeded in blocking a Senate bill that would have expanded background checks. David Allen Penny bought an assault rifle right after his 18th birthday. When he became angry after a traffic accident, Penny started shooting into a house from a 30-round clip. When police arrived, Penny started shooting at them, injuring two police officers. Penny's history of mental health issues led to a light prison sentence, but advocates of stricter gun laws maintain that a basic background check of the young man's criminal and mental health treatment record should have prevented Penny from ever buying an assault rifle. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Revelations about government surveillance of Associated Press reporters' phone records has set off alarms with regard to possible violations of First Amendment rights. The covert surveillance was only discovered when a letter was sent by U.S. Attorney Ronald Machen to the AP's general counsel on May 10th. The AP itself reported that the Justice Department had secretly obtained 2 months of telephone records of AP reporters and editors listing incoming and outgoing calls on work, home, and cell phones, including general AP office numbers in New York, Washington, Hartford, Connecticut, and the House of Representatives Press Gallery. In response to the surveillance, Gary Pruitt, AP's president and chief executive, wrote a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder that stated, "There can be no possible justification for such an overbroad collection of the telephone communications of the Associated Press and its reporters. These records potentially reveal communications with confidential sources across all of the news-gathering activities undertaken by the AP during a 2-month period, provide a roadmap to AP's news-gathering operations, and disclose information about AP's activities and operations that the government has no conceivable right to know." Your reporter spoke with Mark Jacox, policy analyst and legislative assistant with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who expresses the concern of many civil liberties advocates about this instance of government surveillance of news organizations and the Obama administration's plan to overhaul the federal surveillance law, known as the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, or CALEA, to make it easier for law enforcement to tap internet communications.
Right now, we don't know a lot of details. What we do know, though, is that they subpoenaed the call records that were going out. And so the DOJ is able to do this under the law with just a very low-level subpoena. It's really the enormous breadth of the situation. They looked at over 4 stations where over 100 reporters use those stations. So the amount of information and the really aggressive actions to pursue just all these calls coming in, or going out rather, from the terminals is quite stunning.
What should people be alarmed about in this? And the second part of that question would be, is there any oversight here? Is there any judicial or legislative oversight that can put this genie back in the bottle if it indeed is out surveilling reporters?
Well, the concern is certainly the low-level subpoena that they received. It's a very, really quick kind of judicial action that the DOJ is given a large amount of leeway to use and to pursue. And so the concern is really the number of subpoenas they probably received and the amount of information they got from simply knowing who was calling in and out of the offices. In regards to oversight, the DOJ does have a set of policies, and this case does show a clear violation of those policies. When a news organization is subpoenaed or when the DOJ wants access to calls like this or phone numbers, there's a set of guidelines that the DOJ is supposed to follow, and it is supposed to start out with pursuing every other alternative, and then it's supposed to next involve negotiations with the actual news agency. And it looks like the DOJ, again, we don't know much, but what it does look like is that the DOJ bypassed those two oversight mechanisms that are in their own policies to pursue the calls going out of the terminals and the press's offices. So that's really where the oversight is supposed to happen. The next steps right now are really gaining more information, right? We've seen a couple of congressmen and senators come out and call for oversight hearings, and just this Wednesday, actually, I believe there's a hearing on the oversight of the Department of Justice. So we will certainly see a flurry of questions from the congressman towards Attorney General Holder about the issue.
Mark, in a related issue, the Obama administration is reportedly pursuing a change in something called the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, CALEA, which was established in 1994. Apparently, the Obama administration wants to make it easier to surveil communications over the internet. Can you describe what we know they're after at this point and your concerns at the Electronic Frontier Foundation?
So right now, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act was, as you said, it was the law passed in 1994, and it was intended to allow for the FBI and the government to access, once given court authority and court approval to wiretap an individual, it forced the companies to create backdoors that would allow the government to obtain the communications that they were able to obtain under court authority. And right now, we've been seeing a very strong push from the FBI because they're saying that they are unable to access the communications right now online. So they're very concerned with accessing private IMs, instant messaging, and conversations that way. Right now, that's what we know. We know that they want to expand CALEA to these communication service providers, but we don't really know in what way. The fight for CALEA has been a really long fight since 1994, solely because it was only originally intended to cover telecommunications companies, whereas now the government wants it to cover ever more increasing communication services. And the concerns with it, I mean, there are a whole bunch of concerns. What the main point of the bill is to create a backdoor for software communications and for other kind of communications and social media. And these backdoors have notoriously been used by hackers. They've notoriously led to a lot of wasted hours on parts of the company. And so the main concern is that the backdoors are unneeded, make us less safer, and also are a drain on innovation.
What do you think people should keep in mind in terms of government surveillance and their rights? There's always this debate now since 9/11 and even before 9/11 that there has to be some sane balance between security and liberty. Do you think we'll get there? I mean, it seems like the country is still reacting to the events of 9/11, and a lot of what's in our Constitution and Bill of Rights has been severely eroded.
Well, I think it's a constant struggle, but that's why the struggle exists. You can't ever go from one side all the way to the other. There's a constant balance. And especially with the expansion of CALEA, the past investigations and kind of surveillance methods, we've seen a lot of these cases cracked by traditional methods, key logging an individual or trying to just simply follow and get onto the individual's computer and things like that. And so traditional investigatory methods have worked in CALEA investigations, so the expansion is unnecessary. And then in regards to the latter question, it's certainly a tussle. It will be a tussle, I think, for a long time, but that's part of what makes the Constitution, especially the Fourth Amendment, a great result of this country. It's going to be a constant battle, but that's why advocates like EFF and ACLU exist, and that's why there's a constant kind of reorientation around what is acceptable in society and what is defined by privacy and the Fourth Amendment.
That was Mark Jacox, policy analyst and legislative assistant with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Learn more about groups working to challenge the erosion of civil liberties and privacy rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There are growing protests by human rights groups in response to the 4-month-long hunger strike conducted by the majority of 166 detainees held at the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Detention Camp in Cuba, where an unknown number of prisoners are being subjected to force feeding. According to a 30-page military manual used at Guantanamo, hunger-striking detainees are shackled to a chair where a tube is inserted into their noses and down to their stomachs for up to 2 hours at a time. The American Civil Liberties Union, Human Rights Watch, and other groups, who have labeled the force-feeding process as inherently cruel, inhuman, and degrading, and a violation of the Geneva Conventions, have called on U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel to halt the practice. In a related development, attorney Clive Stafford Smith, founder of the UK-based human rights group Reprieve, who represents several Guantanamo detainees, has complained in a letter to British Foreign Secretary William Hague that hunger strikers are being threatened with body cavity searches before they can meet their legal representatives. When President Obama was asked at an April 30th press conference about the hunger strike that now involves up to 130 detainees, he stated his administration is renewing efforts to work with Congress to shut Guantanamo down. 86 detainees at Guantanamo have been cleared for release by the U.S. government, but remain imprisoned with little hope that they'll be freed anytime soon. Your reporter spoke with Carlos Warner, an assistant federal defender representing 11 men held at Guantanamo Bay detention camp, who has traveled to Guantanamo to meet with his clients more than 30 times and has been to the base twice since the hunger strike began on February 6th. Here he challenges President Obama's inaction in releasing cleared detainees and closing the U.S.-run prison in Cuba that he pledged to do when running for the White House in 2008.
What happened was, in September of last year, the guards switched from the Navy to the Army, and a hardened core of guards and supervisors came in. And there's a colonel down there who was just exerting his will on the men. And it began, we started hearing things in the 9/11 trials about their cells being emptied out while they were in court. And then we heard about a shooting in early January, which is unheard of. For 4 years, the men had no problems with the guards. There was no conflict at all. But we heard of the shooting, which really came out of left field. And when I was down in early January, clients told me that Colonel Bogdan and the other Army came in. They took everything out of the cells, and what really finally sparked the hunger strike was linguists that worked with the military were leafing through the Qurans. And this is when everybody went on a hunger strike. And at that time, I said, well, look, you guys can end this now. All you have to do is take very specific steps. The military refused to do it, even though they had taken the same steps in the past, and continue to be aggressive towards the men, which have dug them in further and further. It's a nightmare down there. Just last week, I heard now what these officers are doing. They've ordered that all the men be strip searched now if they come out to take a phone call from their attorneys or talk to their families or have a lawyer meeting. So the men aren't coming out anymore. They're just doing everything that they can to make their lives more difficult, thinking that it's going to break the strike, but it's so nearsighted because it's just causing the men to be more dug in and more unified. This military could completely reverse the course of this hunger strike, but they're so dug in now, that's why we've been calling on the president, because obviously they will listen to nobody, and they are intent on just being very aggressive with the men, and that's just not going to work.
Explain to our listeners a bit about why many of these detainees, and you can certainly enumerate the number, who are cleared for release by several U.S. government agencies but have not been released.
Yeah. Right. Unfortunately, and I come from the left, my wife campaigned for President Obama, and certainly I'm a federal defender, but I can't blame the right for this, even though the president enjoys blaming the right, because he has authority under current law to release these men. And for years, he's blamed it on Congress, and the left has been, it's really kind of taken the bait, hook, line, and sinker, despite what the law has been. Senator Levin, who came out last week, inserted the power into the latest version of the NDAA, actually the 2012 version, allowing the president to transfer these men. So it's not about whether or not President Obama has the authority to do it, it's whether or not he has the political courage to do it. And frankly, going back to the days of Rahm Emanuel, he's made a political decision not to close Guantanamo. Why is that? Because over half of the left think it's a good idea to keep it open. Now, this is an ignorant position on part of the public because they don't understand that innocent men are there. They think it's still the worst of the worst, which it has never been. And 85%, I think, of the right think it's a good idea to keep it open. So politically, he has had no motivation to do it. But this isn't a political issue. It's a moral issue. It's one that weighs on his conscience, and it's one that he's just going to have to make. It takes him really getting a big backbone and saying, I'm doing what's right as commander-in-chief. I'm going to close Guantanamo because it's not only right for our country, for our national security, but we as a country can't hold innocent people any longer. But so far, that message has not resonated with the general public. We have some momentum now. But I have to say, after working so many years in this problem, I have to be pessimistic about whether or not the president will actually follow through with his promise.
What do you make of President Obama's comments in reaction to a question about the plight of these detainees on hunger strike at a recent press conference? He talked about his expectation that his administration will eventually close down Guantanamo.
Actions speak louder than words. And I saw on his face, you know, I watched the election and I was so frustrated that it just wasn't even mentioned. Nobody was talking about it. But actions speak louder than words. So he says that he's going to do it, but what has he done is my question. And right now he's doing nothing. There used to be an office that was closed in the State Department. The first thing he has to do is appoint a high-level official in the White House to kind of moderate all the disputes that happen between Department of Justice, Department of Defense and the Secretary of State. If the president wanted to end the hunger strike, he could call someone like me or my colleagues, and we could go down and mediate an end to this hunger strike in 1 week. But still, no concrete action. And we can't be waiting months and months and months. This is a dire, dire emergency that has to be resolved before someone dies.
That was Carlos Warner, an assistant federal defender who represents 11 men held at the U.S. Guantanamo Bay detention camp. For more perspectives on the Guantanamo hunger strike and prospects for the prison's closure, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 23rd, the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., reversed a lower district court decision that would have allowed the company with the largest mountaintop removal site in West Virginia, the Spruce No. 1 mine, to begin blasting the mountain apart to access the coal seams beneath. The court's ruling, handed down by a 3-judge panel, all of whom were Republican appointees, affirmed that the Environmental Protection Agency has the authority under the Clean Water Act to veto a mining permit even after a permit was issued by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Attorneys from the group Earth Justice worked on behalf of several local citizens groups that supported the EPA's jurisdiction in this case in order to prevent an industrial operation that would cover 2,000 acres and bury 6 miles of streams, some of them headwaters, supplying drinking water to surrounding communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Earth Justice Senior Associate Attorney Emma Schuss, who provides a short history of the now-halted mining operation and its significance to all communities located near extractive industries. The fight over the Spruce One mine is cited by congressional Republicans as proof that the EPA has overstepped its authority. GOP senators are now using that accusation and what they characterize as an anti-fossil fuels agenda to hold up the nomination of Gina McCarthy, current EPA Assistant Administrator in the Office of Air and Radiation, to become President Obama's second-term EPA chief, succeeding Lisa Jackson.
In, I believe, 2007, the Corps of Engineers issued a new permit to allow the coal company to dump mining waste. And that new permit immediately, local citizen groups in Appalachia immediately challenged that permit as unlawful under the Clean Water Act. And so it was, again, put on hold. And during the course of this time, the science was really building to show overwhelmingly that this kind of project causes devastating harm, not just because it completely destroys vital mountain streams that are kind of the starting point for the whole watershed and ecosystem in the area, but also because it puts pollution downstream that kills aquatic life, that are kind of the building blocks for the whole natural area for fish, for birds, and, you know, contaminates the water for communities that are relying on them. And so the science was building this whole time. And a lot of it came to a head in key scientific research that came out in 2008. And then in 2009, EPA took a look at this science and recognized the need to actually take all the concerns that they'd been raising over the years and turn that into action. So 2009 was when EPA started the process for reevaluating the disposal of mining waste under this permit. Now, keep in mind the permit was on hold in that intervening time, so nothing was really happening there. So EPA started the process in 2009, and after going through that careful evaluation, reviewing the science, looking at all the angles of the issue, in 2011 EPA issued its final veto, which withdrew the authorization to dump mining waste into key streams that are some of the only remaining healthy waterways in that area.
So the company won a round a few years back.
The district court initially ruled that EPA did not have authority to withdraw the authorization to dump the mining waste after the court issued the permit. EPA appealed that decision, and on April 23rd, the Court of Appeals here in Washington reversed the district court and found that the Clean Water Act does fully authorize EPA to act whenever it finds that there's unacceptable harm would occur to waters. And so it upheld EPA's authority to act, that it's never too late for EPA to act as long as it can prevent unacceptable harm. And that's a really important component of EPA's authority that Congress granted to EPA under the Clean Water Act.
I can imagine the current Congress never approving anything like that. And in fact, this EPA decision to withdraw authorization for a permit previously granted by the Army Corps of Engineers is one of the things Republicans are now saying shows the EPA has exceeded its authority. And since Gina McCarthy worked directly under former EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson and was very involved in this decision, they're saying McCarthy should not be confirmed as Jackson's successor. But is the denial of the permit final?
It's not the end yet. The Court of Appeals only resolved the question of EPA's authority. So the court said, yes, the Clean Water Act gave EPA this authority to act after there's a permit. It's a very vital environmental backstop that we need EPA to have and that Congress gave EPA. The rest of the case now goes back to the district court. And so the coal company has challenged the veto on some other grounds also. And the rest of the issues remain to be resolved.
But while it's being litigated, the company can't proceed with blasting the mountain apart. Is that right?
That's right. So the project remains on hold. So EPA has succeeded in protecting these vital waterways from the permanent, irreversible harm that this project would cause. This is a landmark ruling for a number of reasons. This case is about one of the largest mountaintop removal mines ever proposed in the Appalachian region. And it's just vital that EPA have the authority to be able to step in and protect communities and waters that would be harmed by this kind of devastating project. So it's a huge moment for communities that have been working for years to try to bring attention to the problem of mountaintop removal mining and to try to help make sure that the people who are supposed to be protecting us, like the people at EPA, really do step up. Now, the broader issue here is also very important because the Court of Appeals did decide that EPA has the authority under the Clean Water Act to protect communities after a permit has been issued. And that's a decision that helps to protect Americans all over the country whenever their waters are threatened by devastating waste disposal from any kind of industry.
That was Earth Justice Senior Associate Attorney Emma Schuss. Find more information and commentary on mountaintop removal coal mining on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.